Wouldn't you love to get paid for doing what you love to do? If you're ready to move on to what's next, join us for Circles of Change with Dr. Zara Larson. Our uplifting live talk show on Saturday mornings from 10 to noon will have you circling back, not running in circles, to pull your experience forward in new ways. Advance your career, plus help others with theirs. Join us Saturdays, 10 to noon, right here on 104.1 The Truth, for pragmatic advice and unconventional wisdom. Circles of Change with Dr. Zara Larson, where your path is created by walking on it. Welcome back to Circles of Change in our final segment here on a special Easter weekend, and we're calling New York City, catching up with Dr. Kristen Neff. Kristen, how are you today?
Oh, I'm doing great. Thanks so much for having me on your show.
It's a real pleasure, and congratulations on the recent release of your book. It must be an exciting time for you.
It really is. I'm quite excited. My first book.
Your first book? That's great. But folks, as you're going to hear this, that does not mean she's not frequently published, by the way, but might be your first book. Let me offer an introduction. Dr. Kristen Neff is an associate professor in human development at the University of Texas at Austin. She earned her PhD at the University of California, Berkeley, in the field of moral development, and during her final year of graduate school became interested in Buddhism. Kristen has been practicing meditation in the insight meditation tradition then ever since. And while during her postdoc work in self-concept development, she decided to conduct research on self-compassion, a central construct in Buddhist psychology, and one that had not yet been examined empirically at that time. Kristen now is not viewed only as a pioneer, but she actually established a self-compassion as a field of study almost a decade ago, and has a scale that, by the way, is leveraged by many other researchers. Her new book, just debuted this week, is called Self-Compassion: Stop Beating Yourself Up and Leave Insecurity Behind. And with that release, she, I suspect, is sure to feel the international pull of now additional lectures and workshops for those wanting to learn how to be more self-compassionate. So again, I appreciate your taking out of time out of your busy schedule.
Well, I'm happy to be here.
You bet. We better first start with that term, self-compassion. And what do you mean by that term? And maybe what don't you mean by other affiliated words in that similar space?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, most of us understand what compassion for others feel like, which is basically noticing when others are suffering, responding with care, kindness, support, and also remembering that everyone suffers. It's part of the human condition, not looking down on people having difficulties who are imperfect, but just kind of accepting them and supporting them in their human imperfection. So self-compassion is really the exact same thing. It's just turning compassion inward. When you notice something about yourself you don't like, when you make a mistake, or just when life's really difficult and challenging, you actually stop to soothe and comfort yourself for how difficult it is. You frame your experience in light of the shared human experience. Oftentimes when we feel imperfect or things go wrong, we feel very isolated in that moment.
And that we're the only one.
But that we're the only one, and it's that sense of isolation which is so psychologically damaging. So self-compassion really, it's self-compassion, but it's really just compassion for everyone and including yourself in that circle of compassion.
Well, part of that isolation piece, though, don't you think, is so much in our culture, at least Western culture, is about be tough, buck it up, just deal with it. And particularly for anybody who's in business, oh my goodness, to ever show our vulnerabilities to anyone else?
Absolutely.
You know, we're just ingrained not to allow that stuff to show.
That's right. And that's some of the confusions you were talking about. Mm. For instance, a lot of people confuse self-compassion with self-pity. It's actually very annoying to be around someone who's lost in self-pity. Mm-hmm. But self-pity is poor me, and it usually involves a real exaggeration of the problem. Well, with self-compassion, it's actually just saying, hey, the human condition is imperfect. It's difficult for all of us. And also one aspect of compassion, as I've defined it, self-compassion, is seeing things clearly, not ignoring the fact that you're suffering. You know, and a lot of people do. They just, you know, stiff upper lip, buck up, don't complain, which means they just, you know, soldier through and don't even stop to say, wow, I'm really having a hard time here. On the other hand, it means not just running away with an exaggerated storyline. So self-compassion is not self-pity. And the other big misconception, the second thing out of my mouth after discussing self-compassion, is it is not self-indulgent. Mm-hmm. That's the number one reason people give for not being more self-compassionate. They really believe that being harshly self-critical is a very good motivator, and that if they were kind and supportive toward themselves, they would just let themselves get away with anything. You know, I don't feel like going into work today. I think I'll just sit home, watch TV, and eat three pizzas, you know. So the reason it is so totally different from self-indulgence, and in fact, the research shows that self-compassion is a much more effective than a motivator than self-criticism, is when you have compassion, the whole point is you want to alleviate your own suffering. You care about yourself. You want to be healthy and happy. So, you know, if that means if you start skipping work or harming yourself through those behaviors, that's not self-compassionate. It's very easy to see with parents.
Yeah. Kristen, wouldn't also this be a situation, too, where you are encouraging people to be of more of the learner mindset as opposed to the judger mindset?
Absolutely. So, in fact, people who are more self-compassionate do have more learning goals. They are more interested in growth and expansion. When you're compassionate, you feel safe. Mm-hmm. And when you feel safe, that allows you to look around you and, you know, explore the world around you. When you're self-critical, you're just lost. You know, self-criticism is a very self-focused mindset. You know, when you're beating yourself up, you aren't really thinking about other people.
Well, and also when things happen to you, which, as you would say, is the human condition, that is what happens to all of us, something happens, and immediately, if you're in that wrong place, you jump to the conclusion that, you know, this is something you're going to judge or follow into being negative or, oh, woe is me, as opposed to if you're self-compassionate, are you not more apt to say, now that's interesting, what can I learn from this?
Yes, absolutely. And especially, you know, when it comes to owning up to our own flaws and areas where we need change. If you're self-critical, you aren't going to admit when you're wrong. It's much easier to blame someone else because then you don't feel so bad about yourself. But people who are self-compassionate, because they recognize it's okay to be imperfect, we all make mistakes, you're much more able to see yourself clearly, see what needs changing, and then do it.
Oh, that's right. Well, you know, one thing I suspect, though, is a really countercultural, and you've been in this whole field of studying self-concept for so many years now in your doctoral studies and postdoc and so on, but this confusion of this, or the race for self-esteem.
Yeah.
You know, it's almost like this religion, and for those of us that are parents, we're always asking, oh my gosh, did I do that? Will that affect my child's self-esteem? Da, da, da. But you're saying, you know, I'm assuming you're saying it's a much bigger picture than that.
Yeah, and in fact, psychology researchers have fallen out of love with self-esteem because we find there's a lot of hidden downsides, not in terms of having it, but in terms of what you do to get it and keep it. All right, so a lot of people, self-esteem leads to an inflated self-image, i.e. narcissism. You know, along with the self-esteem movement, they've been tracking narcissism levels among college students, and they're off the charts, the highest they've ever seen, partly because all the gold stars and your great stickers given out in schools.
And everybody got the trophy.
Exactly. And just think about it. Self-esteem requires being special and above average. If I said, you know, Zara, your radio show, yeah, it's average. You know, you'd be devastated. It's not okay to be
right. Average.
You have to be above average. So what that means is so this comparative mindset where we're only feeling good about myself if I'm better than someone else, and that can lead to some pretty nasty behavior. So self-compassion is not about being special or above average. It's actually about being average, a human being with flaws, and accepting that and actually embracing that.
Yeah, lovely. So the connection then between self-compassion and leading then to greater well-being. Tell us about that in both, you know, you've obviously written about it, but perhaps some of your research work or the studies you've been involved with, the clients you've advised. What's the connection there?
Yeah, very, very strongly related to well-being. One of the strongest associations is with less anxiety. And there's actually a physiological reason for that, less anxiety and less depression. So self-compassion and self-criticism really tap into two different physiological systems. Self-compassion is all about the mammalian caregiving system, that the thing that allows us both to give and receive care as mammals. And research shows when we give ourselves compassion, we actually release oxytocin and opiates, yeah, feel-good hormones. It makes us feel safe, just as if a baby was rocked in its mother's arms. Self-criticism, which is the fight or flight response, where you're both the attacker and the attacked, mm-hmm, releases cortisol, which is the stress hormone, which makes you feel frightened, anxious. So what the research shows is when people give themselves compassion, they change their physiology, they feel safe and comforted because with the oxytocin and opiates, and the cortisol levels come down. So you actually are, you do, your body feels safer when you give yourself self-compassion, and that means that you're going to be less anxious, less depressed, etc.
So, by the way, for our folks who just turned in, I'm speaking with Dr. Kristen Neff, and you will want to go visit her site. It's www.self-compassion.org. You can go on her site and actually take a test about how compassionate you are, an assessment. You also, though, include exercises to help us increase our self-compassion and also some meditations. Explain some of those, Kristen.
Yeah, that's right. So basically, most of us have trained our whole life in the habit of self-criticism. So we have to actually train, practice, exercise being self-compassionate. So I have a variety of exercises. One of the most simple ones is compassionate touch. There's a lot of research now showing that compassionate touch, you know, putting your hand on your heart or stroking your arm, or, you know, maybe when no one's looking, giving yourself a little hug. Again, it changes your physiology. It physically calms your body down and allows you to feel safer and get out of that mode of self-criticism. So that's an easy thing you can do. Very important is to practice new language with yourself.
Oh yeah.
A lot of people don't even have any idea of how harsh they are with themselves. I often have people write down what you say to yourself verbatim, and they're shocked.
Did I really say that to myself?
You know,
let alone what are they letting the tape in their head play? Right.
Exactly.
The committee that we carry around with us all the time.
That's right. And it's not funny, but some people say, "Oh my God, that's my Aunt Edna." You know,
exactly. That's
very
right.
Critical when you're growing up.
Or was that bad boss that I had? Why am I still letting him talk to me?
Exactly. So you really have to practice new language with yourself. You know, how would I say this to myself to be supportive, kind, and caring? And then also, if I really do need to change something, how would I, you know, encourage, support myself to change because I care about myself, but not because I'm worthless?
Mm-hmm.
You know, luckily, people are actually very good at being compassionate to others. We have a lot of practice with friends, with our children. So I really encourage people to use that skill, but just to turn it back in on themselves. You know, write yourself a letter as if you were a friend talking to someone who was going through a hard time. What would you say to them? And then just read the letter and receive the compassion you've just generated.
You know, though, it's often so much easier for us to give others advice than it is to listen to ourselves. So I think that concept you have of write yourself a letter, that's pretty strong. Particularly the whole idea of writing as well allows you to see it then.
Exactly. And then you can sit with it, revisit it later. But, you know, it is quite fortunate that we're, you know, I have to say, especially women tend to be kind, really kind to others, more so than men, and also harder on themselves.
Mm-hmm.
But I often tell women, you know, use the skill you have. You know what language to use. Just pretend you were, you know, someone who was a good friend who was having a hard time. You know what to say, but you have to get in the habit of doing that. And then you actually can wear new grooves in your brain, so your first instinct is to be self-compassionate. But it does take some practice.
It does. So your book is coming out, or it is out now, and
yeah,
I expect it to be fun to see the kind of audience that it draws. I know it has a real cross-generational and cross-role appeal to both for us as individuals, but specifically maybe bring out some of the sections that brought you a lot of, you know, thought around parents and caregivers.
Yeah, so my story is, and it was actually told in a book and a film called The Horse Boy, which my husband wrote about our journey with our son who has autism. And thank goodness, by the time my son was diagnosed, I had many years of self-compassion practice behind me. And I can tell you, it saved me. you know, when he got his diagnosis, instead of immediately hopping on the computer and, you know, what do I do, what treatments, you know, what's this about, the first thing I did was give myself compassion. I really allowed myself to feel my grief. I didn't judge myself for feeling grief. I just really soothed and comforted myself. My husband and I both really, you know, gave ourselves compassion. And then we were in such a better mind state to, you know, help our son, to find out what we needed to do. Or if he was tantruming, autism tantrums are really uncontrollable, can be very publicly embarrassing. So when that would happen, I would just give myself compassion. I would say a little self-compassion mantra, you know, this is a moment of suffering. May I be kind to myself. May I be kind to myself. And that would get me through. And so, you know, all parents, it doesn't have to be autism, just even a neurotypical kid can be a real problem. So it's useful whenever you suffer, you know, it's this friend that's just there for you whenever you fail, whenever you fall down, whenever you're having a hard time. But it's a friend most of us don't really turn to.
Yeah, right within ourselves, isn't it?
Well,
part of the challenge, though, hasn't your work discovered, though, Kristen, is that we lose touch of who our friend is within ourselves because we've got all these layers and layers of the shoulds and shouldn'ts that society and the norms, even some of them imposed on us by our families, and then they get reinforced in the working world, whether that be the for-pay or the nonprofit world, whether we're a public servant or a business leader, you know, that we have all these other uniforms we wear.
Yeah, well, exactly. And that thing about the shoulds, I mean, think about it. Who here signed that contract before you were born that you would be perfect, that life would be perfect, that everything, you'd always be able to control things and reach your goals? There is no single person on the planet that has that situation. And yet, when things go wrong in ourselves or our work or, you know, we don't do as well as we want, we feel like, oh, something has gone wrong. This is terribly wrong. We don't accept that, and therefore we cause ourselves a lot of suffering by resisting the reality that, hey, life isn't perfect. You know, that's okay. We learn more from our failures than any other experience. So when you switch to that mindset, then failure is actually not a bad thing. It's a teacher.
It's a teacher, yeah. That's exactly right. And by the way, it's one that you can reinforce then for your own path and also share selectively at the right time with others in the mix.
Yeah, that's right. And that's why I have to say, I feel so blessed to be able to do what I do because self-compassion changed my life. And it's so wonderful to be able to just help people develop this voice within themselves and to see them change and become happier.
Well, Kristen, your role now is author, as well as I mentioned in the introduction that you do lectures and workshops around the globe. You're also an associate professor, so not just doing research at the University of Texas at Austin, but I assume teaching. So how do you find younger people responding to the information you have to share vis-a-vis those of us perhaps with a little bit more time in the saddle?
Yeah, they love it. I actually teach a course in mindfulness, compassion, and the self. And I also teach it. I teach a course in human development, so I weave this in. And they really love it. They are so open to it. And I think in some ways, because they haven't been as conditioned, you know, they're still in school. They haven't quite been embittered by the real world yet. Although, you know, a lot of stress and pressure, especially I mainly teach graduate students. And it's just amazing. Sometimes you, like, see this light bulb go off over their head, and they think, wow, I never knew this was possible. Sometimes that's almost all it takes to have the permission to be kind to yourself, to cast aside society's message that you have to be hard on yourself, you have to use the whip to achieve anything, because it's just not true.
Well, for those who travel this journey and understand self-compassion, whether it be from the various of experiences you've similarly enjoyed, meditation, taking a deep breath, the physiological side, but yet every day we're surrounded by all this other stuff, you know, all these other, whether it be negative people or those less compassionate for themselves, which can really penetrate our space. So what are some of those, you know, how do I help others see the power of self-compassion so they can heal themselves? So that I can still maintain where I want to be.
Yeah, well, it's funny. Most people respond very well to when they are given compassion.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have someone who's really angry or has this, chip on their shoulder, sometimes if you give them compassion in the right way, not kind of indulging their self-centeredness, but just really recognizing, yeah, this must be really hard for you, it often softens them.
Yeah, that's a good point.
A lot of times people are defending their egos. You know, underneath it's don't judge me. I'm not wrong, because they can't handle admitting that, because they'd beat themselves up. So by giving them acceptance and compassion, you often put down their defenses, and that's one way to do it. Or just leave. That might be the most self-compassionate thing you can do.
That's exactly right. Get them out of the room. That's right. Just get space from it.
That's right.
Well, the reaction, obviously the book is just debut, but I'm sure you've circulated it amongst colleagues, friends, and families to take a quick look. What's been the reaction so far? What's your gut telling? Where are you going with this?
Well, I'm just blown away how positive the reaction has been. I mean, not everyone. There was a large New York Times article that came out about the self-compassion work, and it just spread like wildfire. I think it was the most emailed, piece that day. A lot of interest. So most people respond very, very positively. Although there were a substantial number of people who had a very negative reaction, people who couldn't separate self-compassion from self-indulgence or selfishness. So that was quite interesting as well. And I realized a lot of people cling to their self-criticism.
Because it's safe, right? They know what it looks like. It's safe. So the idea of launching into the unknown, where they might at the same time surface some things they haven't dealt with before.
Yeah. Well, then also a lot of people become self-critical as children, because they really did need to. If you had a very harsh or critical parent, you had to criticize yourself before they got to you. And so a lot of people develop their self-criticism as a way to stay safe as children. So there's actually some people are afraid of self-compassion because they've closed down their heart for self-protection, and opening that up can be scary. And sometimes I would say if you had an abusive childhood physically, or mentally, it's often good to go down this path with the help of a therapist.
Exactly, with someone partnering with you. Well, Dr. Kristen Neff is an associate professor of human development and culture from the University of Texas at Austin. And for our listeners, truly take a good look at her lovely book, Self-Compassion, Stop Beating Yourself Up and Leave Insecurity Behind. So congratulations on the launch, and thanks for sharing some special time here with us today to put the good word out. Kristen.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me.
Your pleasure.
I really appreciate it.
Great. Well, have a safe trip home.
Thank you.
Very good.
Change is chaotic. That is, unless you embrace it, going places you hadn't dreamed were possible. The Larson Group, Architects of Change, is a leadership consulting, executive coaching, and career transition firm. We help individuals make the most of their current employment situation or to step forward confidently into a career transition. Contact us at thelarsongroup.com or toll-free 1-877-544-2580. The Larson Group, Architects of Change, 877-544-2580.